My headache won't go away.
I get blurry vision.
My balance is awful.
I'm exhausted.
We can all get these symptoms from time to time. But if you or a loved one notice you're getting a combination of them regularly, don't ignore it. They could be signs of a brain tumour.
My headache won't go away.
I get blurry vision.
My balance is awful.
I'm exhausted.
To learn more about the common signs of a brain tumour, search Better Safe Than Tumour.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Brain Tumours, the podcast where we'll be talking to people who've been affected by a brain tumour diagnosis, either their own diagnosis or the diagnosis of a loved one. We'll also be sharing news and updates from the Brain Tumour Charity about what we're doing to halve the harm and double survival. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm joined again by Sasha Langton-Gilkes in the second of a mini-series we're doing on end of life. If you haven't listened to the first episode, I'll link to it in the show notes. As you might remember from the first episode, Sasha wrote a book called Follow the Child, which I'll also link in the show notes. Although this book was written about parents' experiences of losing their child, all of what we're going to talk about relates to all age groups. So it doesn't matter whether it's an adult or a child, much of what we're going to talk to in this episode relates to everybody. So we're going to be talking about the difficult subject of the death process. I think this is a subject that people really struggle with. I've had people on the phone to me saying, my mum's going to die. What will it look like? Because for young people, they've never dealt with death before.
My dad actually had. So I was pregnant with Dee Dee when my father was dying at home. I watched my mum, and we were all helping her with dad. He had skin cancer that then went to the brain. And I remember that just total no idea what that looks like. That, as you say, that sort of fear of the unknown is absolutely a colossal. The fact that people are listening to this, hopefully it will break down some of the fears.
So this is why we're doing it. It's one of those taboo subjects but I think we can't shy away from the fact that people are dying of brain tumors and that there are people sat at home right now having to care for somebody who is going through this and they don't know what to expect. They've not got medical experience. They've not got a history. They've not seen anybody die before. They're now dealing with it and don't know what to look for. What is this normal? Is this not?
So you wrote a book, Sasha,
and you talked in detail about what you experienced with Dee Dee. And obviously this is one of those subjects that people don't talk about. People don't talk about what happens in the last weeks of someone's life, you know, what's happening to their body. What is it like to care for somebody or see somebody going through that? Can you share a bit about your experience of that?
It's true that I had watched my father die from skin cancer that had gone to the brain, and he was at home, which is how I knew it was possible to be at home. So I had the huge advantage, I would say, of seeing my father's breathing get slower and slower until it wasn't followed by another breath, and we realised that he'd actually died. And we were all with him, which I'm hugely thankful and grateful for. So at least I wasn't frightened, I realised, of the actual dying, because of course I realized that dad had stopped suffering. And the same with Dee Dee. I knew he would stop suffering. So it was that sort of agony of almost wanting it to happen faster because you cannot stand seeing them suffer. It is so awful. And then you'll be furious. How can I think that about my child wishing it to happen earlier? So it's a sort of, it is a torture. It is a torture to be in that position where you want it to happen quicker to stop them suffering, but equally you cannot bear the idea of not being there anymore, which you kind of also can't get your head around because as human beings, it's a sort of cliff face in our brains, isn't it? You just can't go there.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of psychological torture that you're in, as it were. But from the physical, I realised what an advantage it was when I talked to other parents where they hadn't seen that actually for my father and then for Dee Dee, it was calm and peaceful because we had managed to do all the planning. We did know what he wanted and he had done a will. So do you see what I'm saying? So we'd at least had the sort of peace of mind and the consolation in grief that had been done. But in terms of the sort of process, what essentially had happened, I mean, I have to be clear here that he had a type of medulloblastoma. Well, medulloblastoma was just one thing back in 2012 when he died. And because he'd had shunts, that complicated some of it. So every death is unique. So what I'm saying is, don't think just because of what I say that that's going to definitely happen to your loved one. You know, as I say, there's 140 different sorts of brain tumor.
Absolutely.
Everybody reacts to the drugs differently that are managing their symptoms. But the sort of psychological state for us looking after them is the same the world over. The fact that we could keep him comfortable and he was in the place that he wanted to be with the people that he loves, that is a huge concern. So it's sort of these terrible, sort of bittersweet, you know, incredible moments where he would sort of say extraordinary things, even with dementia. And you'd be like, how is it possible for someone's brain to still do that? Because I think I thought dementia was just one sharp slide. And the answer is, it's not. It goes up and down. Essentially, what you're talking about is a body starting to shut itself down, if I put it that simply. And for Didi, it started because he had so many tumours, millions of them, teeny weeny, all down his spine and brain. It meant that all the messages were getting jumbled up. So he had dementia. For me, it's helpful to say the word, because by not saying the word doesn't mean it's not happening.
Yeah.
And so I had to say that out loud to gather the courage to say that to the nurse specialist.
We hear that with people who are going through their loved one, the personality is completely changed because the tumour is just attacking different parts of the brain.
I looked it up on the NHS website, causes of dementia, less common causes of dementia, brain tumours. I'm like, well, nobody said anything to me. Mm. And the thing is, I know that the doctors, it's so hard for them because, as I say, they don't want to upset us more. It's like, and these are the two biggest taboos. Dementia is the number one health taboo for the public. Number two is cancer. And if you've got brain cancer, potentially you've got both. So it really is, you know, yeah, wow. We ended up with someone with no capacity. So it starts off with him being able to make decisions and being clear. Luckily, because as I say, we'd had a sort of 5-year pathway, we knew what he wanted, what was important to him. So the dementia then, it's not like it was sudden and you're left with someone who's unconscious and you have no idea what they want. Nothing has been planned.
I think that's important because depending on where the tumour is and stuff, Didi had dementia, but I know for others, they lose the ability to speak, for example. You know, there's different ways. Having that plan before communication in whatever form it takes is lost, and you can no longer communicate with that person.
Because he was 16, he was still a child. So that meant that my husband and I still had responsibility for him. I know it's more difficult. So if you're an adult, the thing is, if you haven't written it down and then you're not able to express your wishes and you've lost capacity, if it's not written down, the doctors have the legal responsibility, not the family, which I didn't realise. But as I say, it didn't quite arise because Didi lost his capacity, but he was still technically a child. So we still could make the decisions for him.
And that's really important for adults that are listening to this and thinking about either themselves or their loved ones, that actually if an adult loses capacity because they can't communicate what they want, they may have had those conversations with their family, but if it's not written down, like do not resuscitate and those sort of things, it's no good telling your wife or your husband that, but not having it in writing, because when it comes to it, it will be your medical team.
I think it's, but I know from a girlfriend this happened to, and their children were doing like GCSEs and A levels, and the husband lost capacity, and nobody would. She tried to get palliative input, but didn't realise quite how much you have to push sometimes, depending on where you are. He ended up totally losing capacity, but the hospital appointments were being sent to him, and he didn't know what he was doing.
Yeah.
And it was absolutely. But I think again, if people don't know what's likely to happen, they don't realise how far upstream you need to kind of get stuff in place so that when it gets bad, you've got it covered and you don't end up in the kind of crisis they did with him being basically sectioned right at the end. It was really, really, really.
Yeah, because that's the thing about brain tumours that's perhaps different to some illnesses in some respect, is that although it happens quickly, but it happens slowly as well, in the sense that it's not like a heart attack where someone just drops dead. You gradually, bit by bit, things start shutting down because your brain is the control centre for everything. So bit by bit, things start to shut down.
Yeah, it depends, as you say, what type of tumour, where it is. And again, your team would know what you should expect.
Mm.
So we actually, he didn't lose his mobility literally till about 4 days until he died.
Wow.
And if you think we had a sort of, that last bit was basically about 3 months. To start off with, it was the dementia side of it that was, and seizures. And I, because I'd never had to deal with seizures before, because that wasn't where his brain tumor was. So it wasn't a pattern that I was used to. But again, it would have been helpful to have been told. So when he was having an absence seizure, where he suddenly literally is just not there, he's looking out of the window, he's sitting there, he's not speaking, he's not looking at me, he's not doing anything. He's literally like a sort of statue sitting there looking out the window. And I'm talking to him and he's not responding. And one of the other children came in and said, "Oh, you know, what's for tea, Mum?" And I'm like, "I'm not quite sure at this point, because your brother's, well, I'm not quite sure what's going on." It would have been good to know that absence seizures, that's what they're like.
Yeah.
And this went on for about 10 minutes and I didn't know if he'd ever come back. He did. He suddenly went, "What's for tea, Mum?" I practically passed out because I didn't know what was going on. And I kind of think it was a sort of seizures. And then, as I say, the dementia, his short-term memory went first. And the most difficult thing for me was me, like anyone who has a beloved with dementia is, except of course with a brain tumor, you're doing it at warp speed, is when they get to the point where they don't even recognize you as their mother. I mean, obviously that is just horrendous. But the hardest bit was because his short-term memory went, he'd forgotten that he knew he was going to die, but he knew he had cancer because that had been for a third of his life or whatever.
Yeah.
So he for about a week he went, "Am I having more cancer treatment?" And I'd have to go, "No." And then he'd go, "Oh, am I going to die?" Because it's like he knew that something huge had happened.
Mm.
And he had processed all this, but then the dementia took away the short-term memory. And he did that over and over again. That was without doubt the hardest thing. And my sister then said, "Oh, just lie. Say, yes, you're going to have more cancer treatment." But do you know what? We were told by the nurses right at the beginning, don't lie.
Mm.
Be honest. At some level of me, I thought, I've never lied to him. I've always told him what he asked me, honestly. I mean, obviously age appropriate. I've always told him, if I lie now, I just know that at some level, it's going to distress him. Then his long-term memory started to go, and then he stopped asking because the dementia had just gone. It felt like being on Google Maps trying to get somewhere, and it would say, "Oh, there's a blockage ahead. Right, you're going to go left here." Gradually, more and more and more roads shut down, and you're being diverted into smaller and smaller and smaller roads until basically you know that entire area you now can't go to. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was absolutely horrendous, but that's what happened. But the main thing for me was that he was at home. So this is where place of care. So you've got place of care and place of death. They don't have to be the same place. So we had decided that to move him to a children's hospice wouldn't be in his best interest. Because of his dementia, his body went onto an autopilot. So he knew that if he rolled out of bed, two steps left was the bathroom, two steps left of that was the loo. If we'd moved him to a children's hospice, that whole continuity would have been broken. As it was, he was already confused about who everybody was. So that was super important for us. So it was the right decision. And if I'd known, we could have had hospice care at home, which is something that I didn't realize we could have had. So then the care would have come here. It's not available everywhere, but it's definitely worth asking.
It's good to know that people can ask for that, because it's very subjective where somebody, like you said, place of care and place of death don't have to be the same thing. But people often think, if I've made the decision for them to go into hospice because I can't care for them, particularly if somebody loses mobility or whatever, they can request, as the day is coming closer, where you know you can kind of tell, can't you, yes, that this is coming.
You can. Especially the specialist nurses. I mean, that we had the most brilliant Marie Curie nurses. I mean, not every night, unfortunately. So I did get really knackered. And we had the same two over, let's say, 2 weeks. And actually, both of them had had experience with adult nursing, so they were used to dementia patients, so they could kind of herd him back to bed. Because, of course, eventually what happens, you can't even tell if it's day or night, that you're doing dementia at warp speed, essentially. So as you say, there's lots of things. So I know one parent, for example, where they decided the place of care was going to be at home, but they absolutely didn't want the place of death to be at home, because they wanted that to be really special time where they didn't have people turning up at the door that they had to deal with and explain what was going on. They wanted it to be really special time just for them. So they went into the children's hospice for the death, and I will quote the mother, "He had a death fit for a king." And the other beauty of that is that if you're in the suite, the end of life care suite in a children's hospice, they have, it can be chilled. So you can stay there for as kind of as long as you want afterwards, because the body won't deteriorate because the room's temperature controlled. And you can have friends to stay, the family can come and sleep there, or you can go home and organise a funeral and come back, and you know that your child is safe. And
they have the same sort of room for adults, where if people care for their loved one at home, or if they're cared for in hospice, there is this special place where they can go at the end.
I also didn't know that you could get a chiller blanket. So if you want to have them at home afterwards, you can ask your hospice. It's like an electric blanket, but it keeps them cold. You can have a chiller blanket at home that you plug into a socket. That means, again, you can take that time, especially if you've got relatives coming from somewhere miles away and they haven't been able to see them. And for some people, that's just so important. So there are options. It's just that I wasn't aware of a lot of them. So a lot of our end of life stuff was what the healthcare professionals around us happened to know rather than what was actually possible.
Right.
And I think that was the bit of the book that was most useful. I didn't realize. And even if you're in hospital with your child, you can then go to the children's hospice after the death. You know, there are options there. I kind of, you know, my brain stopped at the death and didn't realize there's that very special time between the death and the funeral where the body goes away to be buried, or, you know, and actually you can drive them yourself. I wanted to do that. And I said, no, you're not allowed to. It's illegal. That's not actually true.
Really?
You can't go. Obviously, you have to have special paperwork to go abroad or go to the Isle of Man, the Channel Islands. They said you can't cross the county lines with a body in the car. That's not actually true. I couldn't have driven because I was too exhausted. I remember asking the mortuary staff at Southampton General, I was trying to understand what would have happened if Dee Dee had actually died in hospital. How does that work? How do you get them out of the mortuary? Do you know that kind of thing? Mm. And they were saying, as long as the body is secure in the car. So, yeah, but mind boggles, frankly.
Oh, I was going to say that you...
But because I was kind of slightly really distressed at the idea of Dee Dee being kept in a fridge and at the funeral directors. And I remember a nurse saying to me later, oh gosh, a lot of parents say that. I said, well, I'm not surprised, but actually we need to make sure that healthcare professionals know that you don't have to do that if you don't want to. He could have avoided the fridge if I'd known, but I didn't. Yeah. So I can't beat myself up. I really can't beat myself up. But going back to the process, so the dementia was one thing, and of that, of his sort of brain shutting down like that, we were lucky we didn't get mobility issues until he had to be in bed anyway. Mm. And I have to say that it was at that point that he did get distressed, because he didn't understand why he was going to bed, or, you know, night, day.
How long would you say the real decline started, where you were like, okay, he's dying now?
That's a really interesting question, because I would say that out of that 3 months, because as you say, people think they're going to die. They think you're dying for 3 months. You so aren't. Mm. Yes, the body's beginning to shut down. But for me, I would say he was only actually dying, really shutting down, you know, all the major organs, those last 4 days. 4 days out of the 3 months.
Yeah.
So I think people think, you know, oh my God, you're talking about death all the time. They're dying all the time. It's like, no. Today, so-and-so is coming around for lunch. Tomorrow, we're flying owls around the kitchen. Mm. The day after that, we're going to have a picnic on the lawn and granny's coming over. We were living. He was only dying those last 4 days. He was in bed and he was distressed. That was the only point, which I think is incredible, that he was distressed, and I knew that I was out of my depth, and I made the call to the clinical nurse specialist at Southampton General. They basically said, give him the midazolam right now. And oh my God, miracle, instantly calm and sedated. So, you know, you know when your loved one is in distress, and the palliative care teams absolutely know what medication can be given for whichever.
And you have all that medication
there, because we'd done the planning, and hence why I'm so obsessed with planning. And also because Marie Curie normally don't look after children, but because he was 16, so he's kind of borderline. Mm. But more importantly, they said, because there's a good plan in place, we'll come. If they hadn't come, I don't know what I'd have done, because I'd have had no breaks at night or in the day. I mean, the mind boggles.
So for them, as healthcare professionals, like having a plan in place gave them the confidence and reassurance to know that all the things were there that they would need. They weren't going to be caught short or suddenly left in
with a child in the community. Because I mean, one of the social workers I remember speaking to when we were sort of planning the book, and I was being put in touch with these brilliant, lovely families and everything. And she said, you had some balls going home with a child with those symptoms, you know, pain, seizures, sickness, because it was on his medulloblastoma. It's at the back of the brain. It's like near the vomit center. He'd always been a really sticky patient, but they just upgraded him to the Rolls Royce of anti-sickness, and that sorted it. So they have loads of drugs, and those palliative care teams, that is their super nerd place. They love, you know, all those drugs they can use to manage the comfort of the loved one. So we had the seizures under control, the anti-sickness under control, pain under control with an absolute arsenal of the most extraordinary drugs. So we started off with the baby stuff when he was in a bit of pain. So you've got, you know, paracetamol, Nurofen, your usual codeine. Then we graduated. As soon as he'd say it was hurting, whatever, we went to fentanyl, Oramorph. Oh, my goodness. All worked. So I have friends who ring me when that, you know, their husband's in pain. I said, that is not necessary. You know, and they think they should try and be brave. It's like, is there anything particularly you're trying to be brave for? Because if someone's coming round and you want to be kind of with it, okay. But please don't, because if you really try and be brave and then the pain gets out of control, you'll have to end up going back into hospital for them to get it back under control.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to do that. And that's the other thing about that I got very upset by, was I heard somebody say, oh, so you know those auto syringe drivers, the little things they put in a little thing into their thigh, and they do them. So for Didi, they were mixing up, seizure medication, anti-sickness and pain meds all in one little file. It's teeny. Unlike my father's day, it was absolutely massive. So it's absolutely teeny brilliant. So it doesn't get into much of the way of the bed sheets kind of thing. But I heard someone say, oh, but don't they just kill your loved one faster? I'm like, no. Oh, my God. Where did you get that from? This is what kept the dose absolutely constant so that it doesn't dip. And we all know what it's like when you think, oh, my God, I should have remembered to take my meds. And then it's starting to get out of control, you know, and it can get out of control so badly if you've got seriously bad things wrong with you.
Yeah.
This is the thing that kept them comfortable, because my biggest fear, as I say, was pain. He was going to be in pain and distress. This is the thing that stopped him being in pain and distress. Marvelous. Don't for one second think they're going to, A, it's illegal for the doctors to give them too much. Every single drop that goes into your loved one, they have to sign for and justify. So do not for one nanosecond think something bad is going on, because they have to justify that dosage and they can. They, you know, so they're trying to keep your loved one comfortable, and absolutely it works. So that's incredibly important. And the other thing was, so that those last 4 days when I would say that he was dying and we had to put him to bed, sedate him so he wasn't distressed. He also, at that point where he lost mobility, he also could no longer swallow. Then I realized why we had all the medication in injectable form. So you don't want to run out of those at a 5 o'clock on a bank holiday. That, again, that's why the planning is so important. So basically I made the call, and they did the auto syringe drive to make sure that all his medication, because obviously he couldn't swallow it anymore.
Yeah.
So that's why it's so important. And food with cancers, it gets to the point where the body is shutting down. It doesn't need food anymore. That's part of a normal death. So if someone's not hungry, you're not starving them if you don't give them any food. And again, that was why at that point, and the GP was with us, because he sort of went through the sort of protocol of, do we want to put in a feeding tube into Didi? And I'm like, why would keeping him alive with food now, when he doesn't know who anybody is, doesn't know where anybody is, doesn't know if it's night or day, he's got horrendous pain, you know, we're having to manage all of this stuff, why would we keep him alive? And I said, surely that is not in his best interests. That's not the loving thing to do. And the GP just said, I agree. And so we didn't. So when you decide not to do a treatment, it's called withholding a treatment. Withdrawing treatment is sort of emotionally much harder, because again, I think you are tempted to think as the loved one that you're killing them because you're taking the tube out that feeds them or the tube that's making them breathe. But the answer is no. The disease or the accident or whatever it is that's got them in this horrendous position is what's killing them.
Yeah.
You are now doing the loving thing to stop them suffering. And that's crucial because the sort of guilt we're all thinking, oh my God, I should be feeding him. We should make him breathe. And the answer is no. So I definitely, for us, withholding that treatment was the right thing to do because he was so close to death anyway. And to make it prolonged, I didn't want to do it.
And when the body's making the decision to shut those things down, it's telling you, isn't it, that body can no longer take food. It doesn't need it, doesn't want it. You know, the fact that, like you said, it's the disease progressing.
Funny enough, so my father, I remember, went through quite a long phase of not wanting any solids, but he was still sort of sucking on the sponge to give some water. But Dee Dee didn't even do that. So we were effectively very quickly, unlike my dad, giving him no food and no water because his body was simply not doing that. He'd had a very, very big seizure the night before. And I thought that was probably going to be it. And then he still seemed to be coming back and vaguely aware where he was. So
from what I've heard with brain tumors, that kind of fading and where people are unsure because as the brain is slowly shutting all the processes down, it can seem like it's shut down, but then it's kind of not.
Comes back again. And you think, I remember thinking at a certain point, how is it? We're ravaged by this horrific disease. He is still functioning at all. Mm. I mean, to me, the human body is a miracle. But as you say, he did do that. No food, no drink, very, very quickly. So that was it. And we didn't do, I think the nurses already knew, we didn't do catheters for urine because I think the nurses, again, they know better. They're used to it. So they were just doing like a towel over him and sort of, you know, you can put a sort of like, not a nappy exactly, but so basically we didn't have to catheterize him, which is, you know, my dad had a catheter, but we didn't need, his was so fast by that point that we didn't need to do that and bother him with that kind of thing. But the food one was interesting because I remember seeing, which made me really laugh because I thought, yes, that is so. So this woman who was caring for her loved one dying, I think she was in the US, and she was obviously facing this and talking about food. And obviously people had questioned why she hadn't fed her loved one. And she said, to me, it's like a rusted car in the garage that hasn't gone anywhere for goodness knows how long. There's no wheels. It's up on blocks. The engine's pretty much rusted away. And you're trying to pour petrol into the petrol tank and it's then cascading everywhere. I thought that's actually a really kind of clever way of making me understand.
Yeah, and it is that thing, isn't it, that people still, like you said, think that you're killing, you know, your loved one, but actually you're not. And it's not like anything you do is going to keep your loved one, you know, your loved one's not going to suddenly spring back to life just because you put a feeding tube in, or because, unfortunately, if it was that simple.
And I mean, luckily, because we were at home, and it would be the same in a hospice, it's harder to do in hospital, all the things that he loved. So the things that we could do were gorgeous, his favourite music, his favourite smells, us chatting in the background, because, you know, I know that the sort of hearing is one of the last things to go. So even if they're not sort of squeezing your hand or anything, so we would sit around chatting, having cups of tea with him. So we were always with him those 4 days. Somebody was always in the room with him. And so that whole thing of being in the place you want with the people you want, and the cat was on the bed, all that stuff is what's so precious. Do you know what I mean? Because those are the things you can do and what is very difficult for hospitals to do.
Yeah.
So basically, essentially, everything starts to slow down. People start to get more and more and more tired. They sleep more until the point where they actually start not just being asleep, but being unconscious and then coming back again. And they're not even aware that they were unconscious. And then that becomes much more than when they were even asleep. So you've got this sort of massive slowing down because they get so, so tired. And when it gets to the point where, like Dee Dee was those last 4 days, he was sedated, but he was also deeply unconscious. But it's quite hard to tell between those two things, honestly, at the end. But he did develop that thing where they're so unconscious, you get a rattle in the back of the throat. And Catherine Mannix, the palliative consultant who's written the brilliant book called With the End in Mind, and she just says it's because they're not distressed. That, I mean, even though it is distressing to listen to, I won't pretend.
I'd say it's probably more distressing for you.
It's awful. It just broke my heart for my father and for Dee. But actually knowing that no one's done anything wrong, that is just saliva. They're so unconscious that they can't clear their throat anymore. So you get this sound. We actually tipped Dee Dee on one side. And actually, I seem to remember the GP put something in his syringe driver that can lessen the sound. And I was grateful. I've got to say, if that drug still exists, well, it probably does. That did help because it is really hard to listen to. But they're not suffering. They're just so unconscious they can't fit. That's important because that's just part of a normal death. If you go onto Twitter, Catherine with a K, Mannix, M-A-N-N-I-X, she's got the most wonderful soothing voice from trying to calm down very, very anxious and distressed patients and their families. And she just talks about this. She does a 3-minute talk about this slowing down of the body, which I think is really reassuring and completely brilliant. I think it's been watched 3 million times.
Wow.
It's called In My Humble Opinion. As I say, it's the top, it's pinned top of her feed.
And we'll link to it in the show notes so people can just go click onto it.
Yeah, and her book's really good. So I remember hearing her talk at the Hospice UK conference, and she said she'd been involved, she reckons, over her career with 10,000 deaths, not actually there, but on the phone in support or in support of the team. And then someone was with her, so she was giving advice or whatever. So they know how this works. So if you've got a clinical nurse specialist, palliative nurse specialist, Marie Curie nurse, district nurse who's done deaths, obviously palliative consultant, they know how this works. You know, so we were constantly being reassured by any nurse who popped in. Marie Curie, certainly they'd come at night and assess him, and we'd talk through what had happened in the day, and then they'd reassure, send us off to bed and said, you know, we'll wake you if you need to be woken. And then the last morning, because as you say, you can't quite believe, is this it? And how long they can hang on. It's like how strong the human heart can be. Wow. Mm-hmm. You know, those 4 days did feel about as long as 40 years or 400 years. But the final morning, the nurse came and woke us because she knew that it was very close. And it was like an hour later or something. And his brother was there, but not his sister, who was at a sleepover. I'd said, you can stay. You know, I've no idea when he's going to actually die, stop breathing, but he'd want you to go to the party. But the good thing was, at least it is a reality when it's in your house. They saw their brother dead. It wasn't something that, you know, there's that tendency to protect by not, but then it's not a reality. Mm. It's, even though it was so real for us and we talked about it and he was here, I think for that entire first year of grief, I actually could not compute he was not here anymore. And we'd had warnings. So God knows what it must be like if your husband dies of a brain hemorrhage from a wife, a brain hemorrhage from a brain tumor in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, because it is unbelievable. It's unbelievable they're no longer there.
And that's the thing as well, isn't it? You've touched on it a couple of times about the grief afterwards. And I think that's something else, isn't it? Because you have this, it can be a long illness, but it can also be a very short illness. And suddenly the person just isn't there. And death is one thing, but then there's the what comes after that.
The grief, and I've literally, this is 10, we had our 10 year anniversary about 2 weeks ago. And I only found out because I'm about to start a bereavement group as part of social prescribing for our surgery in this area, our GP surgery. And I found out about compassionate friends it's to people, they support bereaved parents. I'd never heard of them. And they've got sort of information from anything where if you've had a drug death, an illness death like us, a suicide. It's like, oh my God, I had no idea. It's all the stuff that you don't get signposted to. As you say, Child Bereavement UK, all of this didn't get connected to. And I think if we'd had the hospice home care, we would have done. And the thing about the hospices is, so even if you haven't been involved with them, you could ring them up afterwards and say, we're really struggling with our grief and bereavement. Can you help? And they will.
That's really good to know, because I think people think, well, my loved one wasn't in a hospice, so I can't contact them. But to know you can still, even after they've died, still go to the hospice. Because you're right, the hospices are linked into a
lot. That's right. So I'm incredibly good friends with a mum whose son is still alive and just got married, which is amazing. But it's the kind of condition where he could die tomorrow or in 30 years and they have no idea. And she has been going for bereavement, for anticipatory grief bereavement counselling at the local hospice to help get our head around the fact that you don't know when. I mean, literally, it could be tomorrow morning, just hemorrhage. And that's so hard. But so the answer is you can go before. So I know one, I think the mum that in the book, the one that I found just brilliant was that she'd actually gone to see, because they'd been having conversations and done the planning before, she went to see the funeral director before her son died, her young child died. He was probably only seven, because she kind of wanted to know again what the choices were. And it was through talking to the funeral director that she realized that place of care was going to be at home, place of death was going to be in the hospice. But as you say, you don't realize you can have these conversations. You need permission. You need to know that talking about death, you are not letting your beloved down. You're not giving up on them. You're actually helping create meaning for the whole process that's going to help the whole family afterwards. Mm. You're not going to get yourselves into a horrible stress and crisis laden death.
Yeah. And the reality is, unfortunately, if your loved one has got a terminal diagnosis, not talking about death isn't going to stop them dying. So if your loved one has been told, you know, they have got a tumour that is likely to kill them, unfortunately, not having those conversations isn't going to change the outcome. It's not going to speed it up by having those conversations, and it's not going to stop it by not having those conversations.
I think the other one, because you just touched on it, is the word terminal. I have lots of friends have run over the years, and often, because prognosis is an uncertain thing, I think I always thought that doctors would know when a child was dying. And the answer is, particularly for children, there is no good data on that. Mm. Seriously. Yeah. So you're kind of thinking, how can a doctor not know when someone's about to die? And the answer is, if they're not used to nursing people by the end of their life, they're not used to all the signs. And so I know parents who've, I mean, admittedly with not brain tumors, but who've been blue lighted in, and they've had to say, well, we think they're not going to get it through the night, and they have to prepare the family. And then the next day the child bounces back and says, hi, can I have some toast? Literally. And it's like, it's easy to kind of lose trust in the doctors, because you think, well, if you don't even know when someone's dying, what else don't you know? And the answer is, prognosis is uncertain, full stop.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it's usually statistical. X number of people are supposed to live this long. But as you say, statistics I only found helpful when I was on the right side of them. Yes. And unfortunately, we weren't. We were the 25% that where our son died, not the 75% that survive and are cured within by the time they get to 10 years. So statistics, damn them. But the thing is that doctors are often not clear between the difference between terminal, and people think they're about to drop down dead any minute. Terminal is end of life. That is technically your last year. Now, obviously, it's quite difficult to know that until after you've died. Oh, that was your last year. But when you see people on social media going, I've had terminal cancer for 10 years. No, you've had incurable cancer for 10 years. You are not necessarily at end of life. And that is a crucial distinction. And I keep saying to the doctors, please be clear. And it's not. So people then think, they hear the word terminal, they think everything's over. Mm. We've got no hope. You know, we're not going to have any life. And the answer is there's so much you can do. Even, as I say, Didi, until 4 days before, he was having lots of life. So, I mean, okay, not the one that I would have wanted for him. Mm-hmm. Lots of really, as Deborah, you know, Balbabe's husband was saying, absolutely magical times because we were prepared. And so and then people helped us make those things happen. But difference between terminal and incurable is huge. So it's like, check with the doctor, which one do you actually mean? And if they say, I keep trying to tell them, if you don't know, doctor, say, I don't know, I'm really sorry. Because that's better than a kind of sympathetic silence that terrifies me. That terrifies me. And then explain why you really don't know. Talk about the stats and say, I know this is really hard, but at the moment, if your baseline is, you're still functioning pretty well, I go for it, mate. Do you know what I mean? So this is what my friend's son does. He's got a horrendous diagnosis. He's going on his honeymoon. He's doing this. He's doing that. I mean, with a shed load of medication in tow and an awful lot of telephone for numbers for doctors and hospitals when he goes abroad, and special insurance. But he's not just sitting there thinking, well, that's it. Because it's terminal. I'm dead.
Yeah.
Because you're not. No.
Like you said, it's a really important distinction to make. And I think that in and of itself is helpful for people to be able to use that language and say, what are we talking here? Are we talking incurable? but I still have a life? Or are we talking terminal, get my house in order because I'm not going to be here in 6 months, 12 months?
I think it's that hard thing, isn't it? Because I remember one of the mums in my book, they were given their child's, who was three at the time, as I recall, a dreadful degenerative neurological condition. And it was so brutal, the way it was delivered, that they didn't feel that their child was going to be able to do anything. Mm. And then literally, so they left in total devastation. And I think they'd said, you know, your child's going to live 6 months or something, age three. And then the registrar goes, well, actually, we've got another family whose child, with the right input, so they were doing loads for and with their child. Actually, that child is still alive, aged eight or something. And they'd been basically given the same diagnosis. So I know it sounds crazy, but there is not no hope when you're given that kind of diagnosis. Because, as I say, the doctors don't know when you're going to take your last breath. Yeah. And as we were saying in the last episode, you can still be planning for the future, even though you're accepting that you are going to die. It doesn't mean that you haven't got any hope. I know that sounds totally contradictory, but it's part of our human condition.
I was going to say, isn't that part of life, though? Because right from birth, we all know at some point there's one guarantee. We all know we're going to die, and yet we're all planning from when we go to school. Are we going to go to university? We're all planning our life, and yet we all know deep down inside we're all going to die. We all might think we're going to die at old age, but that doesn't stop us planning for some kind of future.
It just becomes that time seems so much less meaningful. I remember the Stephen Sutton, the wonderful teenager, who, I forget which cancer it was, he died of, and raised about 7 million before he died for the Teenage Cancer Trust. And I remember him, you know, reading him, listening to him, and he's like, time isn't important to me anymore. You know, it's like, why are we qualifying the difference between an oak tree that lives for 400 years or a lily that's perfect for a day? Yes, I do wish that Dee Dee had been even a bit of a shrub, so we lived a bit longer. Do you know what I mean? But I know what he means. It's like time takes on a completely different quality if time is short. But to put all your eggs in one basket and to refuse to have the conversations because you are betting that you're going to be the one person in however many millions that's going to be the outlier on the statistics, the 0.0001% that has a totally spontaneous remission that nobody understands. But the problem is that the downside of that, which is that's seriously unlikely to happen, seriously. Yeah. And then what you're leaving your family with is so awful. I mean, I the family I know really well, and the death was such chaos. What that's left the children who were in their teens is just because the husband would not let the wife talk about it. And therefore the planning was done. It wasn't.
So I think the advice would be talk about it. I think that comes across really loud and clear that you can't talk about this too much. You know, you need to have these conversations, and the sooner you start having them, especially if you have got a fear of what will happen, when it will happen.
And I think I certainly was frightened that I couldn't do it. I know that it's like, you can do it. You're not on your own. And there are people in support. You will have to ask, and you're probably, you know, and unfortunately, because services are patchy, you will probably have to really fight for them, which is awful, but it's true. I also remember hearing Ranulph Fiennes talking about the mountaineer talking about his fear of heights, which I found hilarious. There he is, this extraordinary mountaineer, and being terrified of heights. I remember thinking that my fear of what was coming was like Mount Everest. It really wasn't. So when I heard him saying, you know, he was frightened of heights, it made me laugh. And then he said the guy who was taking him up was like, don't look down. And don't think about what it would be like if you did look down. And I took that to mean in my situation facing all this is actually you're doing all this with love and you're doing your best. And what I really learned from the second one, you know, don't think about what it would be like if you did look down, was don't think about now in this situation where they're still here, what it's going to be like when he's dead, because that's just going to wreck you. And you won't be able to enjoy this moment. And those moments are so precious. Yeah. So I thank Ranulph Fiennes for getting my head there.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I thank you for being so open and honest and being able to have what is a really, really difficult conversation. And I know that this is the sort of stuff that people ask about, and being able to direct people to this. It seems impossible that you'll never go through this. You can't survive this. You can't get through this because it's the worst possible thing you can imagine. But you will, and you will come out the other side, because the things you will do for your loved one, you'll make sure that they get through it.
As I say, I wish I hadn't gained this, but it does give me huge consolation and comfort. It's given an added layer of meaning to Dee Dee's life and death, being able to hopefully help people be less frightened and knowing that there are people that can help. There's so much help that you can get in your bereavement, and the people, the specialists who know how these deaths happen, get that palliative care team as early as possible. You are not giving up. It's the thing that's going to possibly make them live longer.
Thank you very much for joining me, Sasha.
Bye.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you'll never miss an episode. If you'd like more information, you can visit our website at thebraintumorcharity.org or email our support team at support@thebraintumorcharity.org. And finally, before you go, if you enjoyed this podcast, please can you leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts so we can reach more people and raise more awareness.
I'm Tamsin and I work in the individual giving team at the Brain Tumour Charity. Thank you for listening to this episode of our podcast. If you or a loved one have been diagnosed with a brain tumour and are worried about your finances, the Brain Tumour Charity's Benefits and Money Advice Clinic, run in partnership with Citizens Advice, is here to help you. Our expert advisors can help you access the financial support you're entitled to, as well as give advice on how to make the most of your money. To make an appointment with our Benefits and Money Advice Clinic, visit our website at thebraintumorcharity.org/money or call our support team on 0808 800 0004.